All right, well, live from the Del Close Marathon, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. What's up, DCM?
That's right. All right. As many people on the stage as off the stage. That's how we like it. Lovely. Really excited about this conversation today. We're digging into it with three veterans of internet comedy, creators, writers, actors, directors. Yeah? No? Yeah. Maybe?
Yes.
Yes. We have Nick Coker on the end.
Coacher,
excuse me.
Close enough.
Nick Coacher. I won't make that mistake again. Charlie Toad.
That's right.
Oh, Charlie Todd. Sorry.
It's Toad, yeah.
And Paul Gale.
That's it, yeah.
Paul Gale. Paul Gale's here. So Nick Coacher, Charlie Todd, Paul Gale, thanks so much for doing this, guys.
Of course.
Thanks for having us.
And I wanted to sort of get you guys here because the one thing that you guys all have in common is millions and millions of hits on videos that you've been the primary creatives on, right? So maybe let's just walk through for each of you guys what your sort of channel, you know, what the channel of success in the internet has been for you. Start with you, Paul.
Sure. So I had a YouTube channel since I was maybe 14 and then hung out at the YouTube space, which was this thing in place in the Flatiron District. Now it's in Chelsea, and just learned about best practices and also studied at a bunch of different comedy schools, of which UCB is one of them. Mm-hmm. And so was trying to get good at making videos at college, where I went to school for film, and then trying to get good at making comedy by going to comedy schools, and then trying to get good at YouTube by going to the YouTube space. And they all sort of converged a couple of years ago.
And the first big project that you had that sort of hit, which one was that?
I made a video. It was a parody of the movie Her. And instead of a male protagonist and a female voice, it was a female protagonist and Seth Rogen was the voice.
Uh-huh.
But Frank Garcia Hale did the voice of Seth Rogen. And I made that with my friend Ali Vingiano, who now works at BuzzFeed Video. And that one got like 300,000, and Spike Jonze and Judd Apatow saw it.
Yeah.
And then the next week I had another video. It was called The Truth About Being Single, and it was a Valentine's Day video.
Okay.
And that one got like 1.5 million views in a week. So those two happened like a week.
And at this point, that YouTube channel, how many views does it have, roughly?
I guess I should really know the answer to that, but roughly, it probably has like 16 million.
Cool. Rad. And Charlie, your YouTube channel, obviously Improv Everywhere, mm-hmm. has been a home for videos, over 100 videos on that channel, right? Are you over 100 videos on that channel,
yep,
right?
Yep, we are, yeah. So I started the YouTube channel in 2006 when YouTube started. Yeah. Did you start in 2006 too?
2008.
Okay.
Was when we first put up a video.
I mean, the old days of YouTube were so different, but that's when the channel started. And Improv Everywhere started 5 years before that, and I used to have like QuickTime files on my website that would crash my server if more than two people wanted to watch it at the same time.
Yeah.
And then, so when YouTube was created, it like actively solved a problem I had, which is I don't have the capability of posting videos. This is amazing. So I was right place, right time in a big way of just already had all these videos ready to go when YouTube existed and had a couple of videos get featured on the front page. Like a lot of people who are, became YouTube stars in the mid to late 2000s, it was because they got that feature, which now it's all an algorithm that does it. It's,
right.
You know, an algorithm decides that you need to see 7 Jimmy Fallon videos on the front page every day. but back in the day, there was a person or a small group of people who would curate it and make that choice. And if you got on that front page, you were likely to get 1 million views on that video, if not many more. And that I got featured maybe 3 or 4 times over the course of a few years. Mm-hmm. So that's what really built up the YouTube subscriber base for what it's worth.
What about you, Nick?
So I have a channel called Britannic with my buddy Brian. It's an amalgamation of our two names, and I find it very embarrassing now, like about 8 years in, to be like, oh yeah, we're Britannic. We're two adult men who go by this fake weird name.
Yeah.
And we put up a video. We were friends from childhood, and we both ended up going to NYU. I went for acting. Brian went for film. We started making sketches, I think, in 2007. And we'd been working together to some extent. Then we put up a couple videos early 2008. And they did fine. I was in another sketch group that had gotten a video featured on the front page of YouTube back when that mm-hmm. meant something. And that had sort of helped kind of drive some traffic to, because that sketch group was kind of defunct at that point. And so that helped drive some traffic to Britannic. And then I think we had like some videos do, like all the videos did decently well, but the first like really big one was this one we did called the Academy Award winning movie trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Which was in 2010, I think, and it was a parody of a movie trailer for an Academy Award winning film where all the characters are like speaking the formula for that type of movie. So they'd say like a toast establishing me as the handsome protagonist or whatever, and then you know another character would shout something like complications or whatever, and that got pretty big. I think it was like 6 million views, and we got sued for it. And
wait, really sued?
Well, sort of. We didn't obey any copyright laws.
No one did.
So yeah, we just put in some like. I think it was like the thing we got sued for is hilarious because there's a very copywritten song that we used that we didn't get sued for. That's like one of those classic movie trailer songs. But then what we used was like a drum beat. It was like a, like the most generic thing in the world. And the people found it and demanded like $36,000.
Wow.
And our agent handled it. He basically said to them, well, that's not going to happen. So either you can sue them for that an amount of money that they don't have, or we can pick a number that's reasonable. And they were like, all right, $16,000. And he was like, how about $2,000? And they went, fine.
Wow.
So.
Wow. That's crazy to me.
And then we had to take the video down and we put a different drum beat in and then put it back up.
You lost the views.
We lost the views, yeah.
So even though you paid him money, you couldn't keep the video up?
Yeah.
It wasn't a licensing fee. It was like restitution.
It was just punishment. It was like an old-fashioned shakedown.
I mean, the early days of YouTube, like it was like people were just putting episodes of The Daily Show up there. It's why Viacom sued YouTube. And I had all kinds of, you know, copywritten songs in my early videos. But none of them ever gotten taken down. It was always just like now they have Content ID where the record label gets ad revenue.
It was like, I don't think they had any authority to actually tell us to take it down. I think they were just like, and take it down. Like, I think we probably could have left it up and they wouldn't have cared because they got.
It's weird that you actually paid money and they still sort of had that.
Yeah.
Leverage. We had a similar thing. There were some videos on UCB Comedy's YouTube page that had not a dissimilar issue, and it was a fine that got paid in order to keep the videos up.
Yeah.
But that was the idea. They would have paid it unless we could have kept the views.
Mm. Yeah.
But that's wild.
Well, now that I'm hearing this all out loud, I'm seeing a better way of negotiating that situation.
It just seems like it's like the equivalent in software of a patent troll, like just like a drum beat troll.
Yeah.
Just like puts out beats and hopes people takes them so he can like blackmail them.
It does sound, though, that the commonality here, though, and the word that's being used here as the sort of vehicle towards virality was YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's actually something that feels like it's changing.
For sure. I think it was definitely a sign of the times. And in the same way that like VHS to DVD took 20 years and then DVD to Blu-ray took even shorter. Or maybe I'm screwing the numbers up, but there are like a lot of different more viable networks.
Yeah.
But at the time, like 2006 to 2014, it was pretty much YouTube if you wanted to make videos.
And at this point, since both of... Like, well, now, Paul, you're at the Huffington Post, but are you also doing stuff on your channel still?
Is not
still
really. I mostly make stuff with Huffington Post, but they're almost exclusively on Facebook.
When you guys are releasing content now, what's that mix look like? Have you shifted to Facebook? Is Facebook the sort of destination for that stuff?
I am still on YouTube almost exclusively. Uh-huh. I'm debating putting out my newest video on Facebook and on Tuesday. Like a week later, so it'd be like a window.
Yeah.
YouTube is the only one that pays.
Mm.
And Facebook, Facebook tricked all of us into like amassing a fan page. They tricked us all into putting their logo on our websites. You gotta like me on Facebook. And they gave, and it was great for a long time, where if you put up something on Facebook linking to your website or linking to your YouTube channel, you'd get a lot of traffic. And then about, maybe it was 4 years ago at this point, Like on the same day that they said, you can pay us money for more people to see your posts, they cut your reach by like 90%. So, you know, I have like 300, 400,000 likes on Facebook. If I post something like before that change, it would be like, you know, 5,000 people might like it. And then they made that change and it went to 500.
Mm-hmm.
On the same day where it was like, you can pay us money to get your fans back.
Right.
You know, but these people, like, I asked them to come and sign up and like this because they wanted to follow me. Anyway, I hate Facebook. But it is the internet.
Yeah.
And I think that's a tragedy. It used to be that America Online was the internet, right? Yeah. And there was this terrible walled garden. And then the web was created. And then everybody had their own independently owned and operated websites. And now we're all just going back to being on somebody else's farm. We're all just sharecroppers on Facebook's farm. Not sharecroppers, slaves, because there's no money, right? I guess Facebook is talking about maybe one day we might pay creators. But at this point, if we all just give in and we all just put our content on Facebook for no money, why would they pay us?
Yeah.
They may pay Huffington Post. I think like they probably pay BuzzFeed. But for an independent comedian like me, you know, it's not that YouTube revenue is good. It's bad, and it's not my business model.
Yeah.
But just the respect of their ads playing on the same page before, during, or after my content, that I get a percentage of that is important to me.
Yeah.
And Facebook doesn't do that.
I like that perspective. I don't hear people saying that. I don't hear I don't hear comedians who are making content and putting stuff out saying that. They say, maybe Facebook juices the numbers a little bit, but like they're okay with that because that's the place where eyeballs are connecting with work now.
What I'm saying is both right, correct, and just, but also short-sighted and probably foolish.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm probably going to put my new video on Facebook. And I'm really mad about it, as you can tell.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is where the eyeballs are, and you're not going to be able to make a sustainable career on ad revenue on the internet unless you really scale up, or unless your production value is I stand in front of a green screen and comment on other people's videos,
right?
Which is a lot of YouTube, and those guys do make a lot of money because they can shit out 7 videos a week where they comment on things that they didn't create,
sure,
and have very, very little overhead, very little cost. Facebook is where the eyeballs are. They have, I think, criminally adjusted their algorithm to favor their own videos rather than YouTube or somebody's own and operated site. So you kind of just have to, you know, play by their rules. And you mentioned views too, Nate, and I think that's another really criminal thing they've done. Trump likes to talk about China devaluing its currency and how that's wrong. Facebook has devalued the view. Like, you know, the fact that you had a video with 6 million views, like, that's a point of pride, and like, your total view count on YouTube is a point of pride, and you can go, whether it's a brand or whether it's somebody that you want to... or you're interviewing to work on a TV show or whatever, to be able to say, my channel has 60 million lifetime views, like, that's a currency that's important. And Facebook has just completely destroyed that by counting a view as 3 seconds with the sound off while you're scrolling through your feed. Yes. That's what a view is on Facebook.
If you're a slow scroller, that's a view.
So, and I also, I have a friend that works at Facebook, and he told me the other day that something like 80 to 90% of Facebook views are on mute with the sound off, which is why you have to do subtitles on Facebook. But I find that too. Like, you know, I'm like on the toilet or in bed and my wife's asleep or whatever. I don't want to have the sound on, and a video comes up and it's like, if it's captioned, I'll watch it.
No, that is wild. Like, we're actually considering investing in some sort of like, there's like software that can automatically subtitle for that exact purpose. Because in delivering these things now, it's like you need to burn those subtitles in. That's the way to sort of get people to watch it. It becomes a whole different sort of
game. But then the thing that's been on my mind lately is like, okay, so if I want to do well on Facebook, I got to like burn in these subtitles and I have to optimize it for somebody who's on the toilet scrolling by for 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And it's like, you got to make those first 3 seconds amazing and you got to have the stuff. It's like, okay, but what the fuck? I don't want to make that video.
Yeah.
Like, at a certain point, it's like, wait a minute, remember you got into this because you're a creator who makes things that you're proud of that maybe could be screened in, you know, on a big screen one day at a short film festival. Like, so, you know, it's
and I think
the push and pull.
That's also a matter of perspective, because I think that the people who you're talking about who are making those 7 things a week that are low production value, that's not what their intention is. Their intention is to work in that sort of digital space that probably, like, that is the end goal, right? It's not about creating something that transcends this sort of, like, short digital, you know, structure. Is there, how, I guess, how do you feel about any of that, Paul, as somebody who's working, you know, for a company that is seeking popularity through the videos, mm-hmm. right?
Well, they in the same way that Charlie was early on in YouTube, they were very early on in Facebook.
Yeah.
And so they put all their weight behind Facebook. And I do think that for people who want to make short films like the ones that we do, Facebook is a good place to get those eyeballs, but not necessarily get people to really, truly care about it. Because unless someone is going to your Facebook page versus YouTube, where they can look at the subscription feed and they would find you, like, whatever, like, it's not your decision, the user or the creator, what shows up on the newsfeed.
Yeah.
It's Facebook's decision. And so, like, if you want to create a loyal fan, retention rates of, like, the amount of people who watch the whole video or most of the video on Facebook are significantly lower than YouTube. So when people go to YouTube or a place like Vimeo or a place like Netflix, they're going there because they want to watch a thing. On Facebook, they want to find out who's getting married, who's getting divorced, you know, what kind of subtitled news thing happened.
Yeah.
And not necessarily are excited to watch your video.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, Facebook used to be like a way to drive traffic to those people. It's like to allow people to go into those spaces where they could sit and watch a video. And now video is just sort of part. It's like they're just longer pictures on Facebook.
Sure.
And so you just kind of have to deal with that. And maybe you find a way to make something that has the sound off 3 seconds. First 3 seconds are interesting. That helps create an audience for the things that you actually do care about, those longer short films that could be played somewhere else. So it's really just about changing your strategy and unfortunately having to be less pure if you want to have larger audience numbers.
Sure. What about for you, Nick? Are you guys still creating in an active space?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. We are very lazy. So we did put up a video earlier this year. We have another video that we've shot that we just haven't edited, and it's just sitting there. And so it could be, you know, we could probably have it done in a week if we wanted to, but it'll probably be like 6 months from now that we finally get it up. And I think the way I feel is like, it's like we never wanted to be that big on YouTube. We wanted to make it was all about just kind of, we wanted to work in the industry. And so it was like, we wanted to sort of use YouTube as a jumping off point. And so initially the plan was just to make a couple sketches and then hopefully get representation from that and then be done with it. And then, you know, get cast in Star Wars and, you know, go do that thing, you know?
Sure.
But then we started really liking it, like making the videos, but we were sort of told or approached by some channels like about, you know, how to gain more popularity on YouTube and become one of these top people. And it's like Charlie said, it's, you know, lots of just, it's talking to the camera and commenting on whatever, like not having anything, you know, just doing those like really quick cuts and stuff and updating like once a week. And we just didn't
Too slow now.
I think
it has it's to like be every like day 5 days a week.
We just didn't have any interest in that because one, it's like you get branded as, okay, this person is like all the top people on YouTube, they're millionaires. So maybe I'm wrong about this, but they are really stuck in the YouTube world. Like I feel like a lot of the industry doesn't have that much interest in working with them. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's fair to just to brand someone with just a YouTube star, but I think it does happen. And so we were nervous about that and we didn't want that to happen. And we were lazy. it's mostly laziness.
And you were successful. I'm rationalizing our
laziness with this sort of...
It's funny that you say that because most of the stuff that you guys do though feels ambitious.
The projects
themselves feel big.
Yeah. I think that's also part of it is that we could only do stuff that we were excited about.
Yeah.
And so when we would make something, you know, we put up a video earlier this year and like before that we hadn't put up one for 2 years. And it's just because we just didn't have there wasn't any idea that really excited us. And that's kind of how I much prefer to operate.
Sure.
Is doing something, and it's not a viable way to make a living, certainly, but it's, I think there's so much stuff out there right now. There's just so many videos, and some are amazing, and some are terrible. And if you're going to just throw an idea on the pile, I think it's got to be something that you really care about.
Yeah.
Otherwise, like, why do it? Because it's just going to disappear. And it's like I'm just listening to the idea of like subtitling a video for someone to silently watch. And it's the same thing. Like, I'll watch those videos, definitely, if they're subtitled, because I don't want to play sound for whatever reason. But it's not, like, the type of view that I really want.
Right. That you value.
Like, it's, like, just who, you know, that's not... I don't think I could tell you any video that I watched like that. I don't think I could describe it to you. It doesn't make any impression on you. So, like, I think there's certainly things that we could do to be smarter and market ourselves better, but we just kind of, the thing that we tried to operate under is, like, just if you make something good, it will get seen. And that's becoming less and less true by the day, but I think that it's still, you know, I'd rather people be able to go to our library of sketches and watch a pick anyone and have that one be good rather than go to it and be like, oh, they did a topical sketch about, like, you know,
the Brexit.
Yeah. Or, right. You know, what Donald Trump said this week, they mm-hmm. made a music video about, like, his social faux pas or something that doesn't have a life after 3 days.
Yeah.
So what's kind of interesting is what it almost sounds like then is that you guys have three different perspectives on the functionality of what that YouTube channel was intended to do for yourselves. You're saying this was something for you guys that was passion, that was also about getting noticed and then being able to stop doing it in a way, right? So transitionary. And it also feels like, and maybe this is wrong, Paul, but that your channel has been the thing that leveraged you into the job. Right.
Oh, yeah. So
you're still doing the same type of comedy you were doing, but now inside an institution.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little tweaked because they have a different perspective on what they want to do versus, you know, some 23-year-old kid.
Sure.
Not anymore. Not 25. I had something I wanted to say and I totally forgot what it was.
Well, I was just going to say, and then Charlie, it seems like for you, that YouTube channel is a brand that is, you know, is synonymous with you as well. It feels like in terms of, like, thinking about creating that content, it almost feels like same, like, success on all these channels, but two different ends, right? And maybe that also is part of the perspective here.
I remember what it was. So I had a few of those videos, the two that I mentioned, and there were a few more, and there was one that based on an essay that a guy named John Purcell wrote, mm-hmm. and I made it with this guy named TJ Misney, who shot and directed it.
Yeah.
And it got 7.5 million views in a week, and that video very distinctly changed my life. Like, the industry, the TV movie industry took me a lot more seriously. And for example, this job, I got it probably off the strength of that one video, plus the fact that I had a couple of others that did all right. And I did a lot of voiceover, like montage videos that had voiceovers, mm-hmm. and I got a voiceover agent. Not something I was looking for, because I had voiceovers in my videos.
Yeah.
And got a manager and an agent just through my YouTube channel. So it definitely helped, like, with the larger industry, with the industry at large.
Yeah. What in terms of, like, in the creation of content for yourselves, right? What are the roles that, what's the contribution that you've primarily done on those things? For most of this, because I saw you work with TJ a lot, right?
Mm.
He's shot a lot of the videos.
Yeah,
that
shot and directed.
You were writing and acting.
Yeah. And producing.
And producing. Mm.
Just out of necessity.
And Charlie, you sort of transitioned from being in front of the camera in most of those videos to sort of being behind it, and now brand yourself largely as a writer, director, producer, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's fair.
And Nick, it's also been, like, I guess on your channel, you guys were writing and performing. Were you also directing?
Yeah, well, it was when we started out, it's sort of ever evolving, I think. But when we started out, it would be like one of us would write a sketch, the other one would kind of give a few notes, and then we'd, you know, Brian would direct it and then edit it. And then as it went on, it became much more 50-50 where mm-hmm. we would both be writing together from moment one. We'd both, you know, would be like on set and like normally how it works on set is Brian takes more of a technical, the technical lead. Like he's choosing most of the shots. He's sort of thinking about how it's going to fit together technically, and I'm working more with the actors. But that being said, that's very flexible.
Mm.
And then he'll do most of the editing. He'll do like a rough cut, and then I'll come in, and then we will fight and scream over, you know, how long some like a pause should be.
Sure.
And then we obviously both act in the video as well.
And I guess, like, in that regard, then, how has, like, so I guess the primary thing then that I guess I'm saying is what I drew lines between you before, but it seems like the thing that is common between you all is that you've used these channels too to be reflective of your voice, right? And it's also been stuff that finds success on the internet. What's the calculation, or what's the balance of calculation between an idea that you're passionate about, but an idea that's also the right format for internet release and success in your minds?
It's something I grapple with all the time. I have a lot of ideas that are really fun, but now that I'm working on Facebook, they have to be, people have to attach their identity to it somehow, to something that they think they're going to share, or that I think that they're going to share.
Yeah.
And that's very different than something they think is fun. And so it's really just about coming up with enough ideas and hopefully picking the one that fits in the middle the most.
That fits in the middle between something that feels like it's your voice and something that feels like it is shareable content.
Yeah. And I think that comedy, ideally or often, is it comes up against people's thoughts about who they are and what they think. And so it's kind of difficult to make shareable comedy, at least Facebook shareable comedy.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, it's a monkey falling down a hill or something.
For you, Nick, is that a factor at all? You guys also seem like you come from a place where the passion is the most important part.
Yeah. I think we don't really think, I mean, we've thought about it. It's usually a second thought. Normally like, what do we want to do? Is this funny? Does it make us laugh? And if it makes the two of us laugh, then we'll do it. And we, you know, don't have anything going on that weekend or something, then we'll we'll work and sure. make it.
The stars align.
But like, and we'll also kind of think, oh, this will be, this could, I could see this going viral. Almost always we're wrong about that. And like, the thing that I found that is so crazy, because people like operate under this belief that celebrities make the videos go more viral. And I think that to some degree they might, like they might get you to a certain threshold, maybe, but in our experience, almost every video that we've used a celebrity in, it has gotten less views than another video.
Yeah.
Like, and
I feel like Funny or Die changed that. Like, in the early days of YouTube, it was like, oh my God, a celebrity is doing something on YouTube.
Right.
And then Funny or Die seemed, when they came around, it was like almost every video had a celebrity on it. And it just eventually, that high wore off. And now it's like no longer interesting or notable that a famous person is in a web video, because the Tonight Show and every late night show has clips with celebrities playing games or doing whatever every day.
Sure.
Yeah.
For you, Charlie, is it, at this point, you with the over 100 of these videos, or 120 or 150, like it's do you know what the number
138,
is? 138. Okay. So for you, that brand is so established. Mm-hmm. You're also factoring in, is this an idea that feels right for this channel, as you know, and what it is and what the experience is for the eight, like what's that balance for you? What's that process?
Yeah, I mean, Improv Everywhere definitely has a style and is known for a style, and the people that subscribe to us want to see us do our thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but fortunately that is what I want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I trapped myself into doing this for, you know, I never thought I would do it for this long or I would make that much content, but fortunately I really like it and I'm really passionate about doing fun, surprising, unusual things in public spaces, and I still love doing it. I think the thing that I struggle with is, because I do live events and because there are two different audiences, and one audience is the people that see it on a subway car or a public park or a sidewalk, and the other audience is the person that's going to see it on YouTube, and that's the balance that I have to strike, is between creating a project that's really great and impactful in a public space but also makes a good video. And I think sometimes I'll have ideas like, oh, it would be amazing to do this, but there's no way to film that, or it's too complicated to be able to describe in 3 minutes, or it's a kind of situational thing where only New Yorkers would understand this peculiar thing about this subway station that I'm, you know, doing a project about. So I do think about that, like trying to do things that could be appreciated, you know, without needing a lot of context.
Sure.
And then the struggle of, this experience will be better if we don't put a camera on a ladder back there in this corner of the park, because people won't see the cameras, but the video is going to be 100 times better if we do put a camera on the ladder. So I, you know, the production company Diverge produces my videos, and you know, on as we're doing our camera plan or as we're in the space getting ready to go, like there's constant battles between you know, the other producers there and the director of photography of, you know, me trying to scale back their production.
Sure.
And them saying like, okay, Charlie, we can do that, but the video is going to suffer in this way and this way, and we have to make compromises and figure out, you know, the best way to do it.
Rad. So something else you guys talked about in terms of pushing stuff out there and it finding success. You mentioned that that period of time when YouTube had a person who was making some decisions. And that's not the only sort of like circumstance where having a connection to a real human being is part of the strategy towards promoting your work and having it be seen on the internet. There's way more of the personal relationships than I think most people, you know, than the average person sort of sees. We assume that it's all algorithms. In some circumstances, it is.
Wait, who do you know that you can introduce me to?
Who thinks that it's that?
No, that who do you know at Facebook and YouTube that can help me with my videos?
Oh, I don't know anybody at Facebook or YouTube. But what I'm saying is that, like, are there relationships that have driven the success of your content too? Like, for example, Charlie, I know that, like, you know, websites like Gothamist like post a lot of stuff of yours. Like, I assume that's not just the tips line that you send in blindly at this point.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
somebody.
No, I think developing a relationship with curators and bloggers and journalists is important. And yeah, when I have a new video, if I feel like, oh, this is a uniquely New York video that celebrates New York or is in, it's on the subway and Gothamist covers weird things on the subway, you know, I'll email their art editor and say, hey, I thought this one would be good for you guys. And she might cover it and she might not. And yeah, in the same way, just one strategy that I've developed is if somebody covers me, I will note it. I have a Google Doc that's like video release day checklist. And I have a list of like this person, you know, from The Daily Dot covered your video that you did last Christmas, and she's a UCB performer. So I should email her when I have another Christmas video or whatever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or even just someone without the personal connection, like this person at Gizmodo covered this video. Now you're releasing a similar one. Go to that person's Twitter, find their email address, or at reply them if you can, and say, hey, you covered my project last year. Here's a similar one. Thought you might enjoy.
Yeah.
And that works. But I think those kinds of, like, those websites are becoming less relevant, right? I mean, dot coms are becoming less relevant. So whereas my latest video, Boing Boing covered it. And if that had happened in 2006 to 2012, huge deal.
Yeah.
But I don't see the traffic or the bounce from it like I used to. And I think just universally owned and operated .coms, like, and I don't do it. I don't, like, go like, let me type in gizmodo.com and see what's going on there. I still use a RSS reader, but I'm in a small minority. But
I use an RSS reader and also do type in gizmodo.com. It's one of the only sites I do.
So, you know, I think that's another thing that Facebook and I guess social media in general has changed, that, like,
sure,
you can have I've had videos that have been covered on, you know, 20 sites that to me are aspirational to get on and it not really move the needle because, one, those sites are doing 100 posts a day, and it's, you know, you can still get lost in the shuffle.
Sure. What about you, Paul?
I have a similar thing. It's probably a lot less organized than Charlie's is, but I have amassed a number of publications that have written about me and connections, personal connections, maybe people I've never met in real life, but people who I've emailed back and forth with enough. People have been nice enough and have liked my work enough that there is a list of those people, and then also like a list of industry people that I maybe have met with or want to meet with, that if I'll send a video if it's particularly relevant to their destination.
Sure.
And then also collaborators, people who are local to New York or people who aren't local to New York, who are friends of mine on whatever the platform is, mostly YouTube, being like, hey, because back in the day, likes or comments used to make more of a difference. But I do think it's a really important point that in late 2014, when things were going very well for me on YouTube, embeds did solid numbers, not amazing, but definitely solid numbers. And now I don't know if they would. And for the same reasons that, you know, a Facebook embed of an article is not going to get nearly as much traffic as it would now. And so you would be better. I've been doing something where I will have my video uploaded on Facebook and pray that a large publisher will share my post on my Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And if not, I'll give them the raw upload.
Wow.
And have my page tagged in it. Oh, and hopefully have my social stuff at the end of it.
Really?
And, you know, so I can give it to a place like Thrillist and it might get like 800,000 views and I might get 2,000 likes or 500 likes or something.
Huh.
I don't feel like it's cannibalizing because they're all so siloed. Like people who follow Thrillist would not see my small Facebook page.
Sure.
And so I'm just getting other views, and I can count that toward my total view count, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So this is not for like HuffPost videos. This is just still independent.
However,
making.
Publications like HuffPost do have arrangements like that. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Where they do video shares.
I get people asking me that, like, "Hey, we love your video. Can you give it to us?" Mm. You know, and that surprises me that you do that. But I see that there is the value in getting additional likes.
Yeah.
To your channel, but my response is usually no, fuck you. Or give me money. Like, no, right. You can't have, I worked on this. It cost me money. I made it. You can't have it.
Yeah. I
embed it. It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
You're welcome to share it.
But the thing is the traffic from Facebook is going to be way more.
I know.
Yeah. Is any of that process have been a factor for you?
I'm
guys?
Learning lots of new tricks
yeah.
here. I mean, it's, we're so lazy is the thing. I email Adam Frucci at Splitsider and I go, "Hey, we've got a new video when we have a new video." And I don't know what that really does. They put it up on Splitsider and that's, and like, as far as I'm concerned, I'm like, cool. Like, and then other sites will sometimes share it. But yeah, I'm like, I don't really understand anymore how it works. We probably should upload our videos onto Facebook. I don't want to to do that because of any moral stance about making money, just because it's work and it's something that I would have to go do.
Sure.
I also think it's about your goals. Like at this point, if Charlie gets a write up from a good site, like he's had that experience and he has the pedigree of that. But if you're a new creator and you're trying to get representation to get credibility and you have BuzzFeed write up one of your videos, like that could make a big difference in your career at that time. So I think there is still value of getting the name recognition, even if it really truly only does bring 500 to 2,000 views.
Right.
Yeah. It's all about where you are in your career and what you're looking for. And if you're still building your brand or making a name for yourself, then yeah, I think giving your video to another outlet to distribute could be good. If the goal is I just want people to see this.
Yeah.
Then, you know, the thing that I struggle with is that oftentimes when people do that, like, it's the headline is always like, some guy made this video about Starbucks names, you know, and it's not like Paul Gale, director and comedian in New York, made this amazing, like, you know.
I was actually pretty lucky for that video, and people did credit us.
That's
as
great.
Filmmakers. Yeah.
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 The thing that I've found, though, I don't know. This is probably incorrect, but this is what we operate under, is that, like, you know, you can do that, and these sites, even if like all of these sites share it, it'll definitely get a lot of views, and it'll get a certain number of views. But I think there's like a point where if a video is like really good, it doesn't matter. Like, if it's, like, really something great, people will share it and watch it. And because, like, we've had videos where it's been shared by a number of big sites, and it just still hasn't, not much has happened.
Yeah.
And then we've had other videos that are, I don't even know if they've really been shared, but they've, like, blown up in a huge way. And I think that's what we're more interested in capturing, is that thing where people go, oh, this is... Because, like, I don't do this that much anymore, but I used to. Whenever I saw a video that I really loved, anybody who came within arm's reach of me, I would sit down and make them watch it. And that's kind of more what the type of view that I want to get, is I want to get, like, people, like, going, oh, you've got to see this video.
Right.
Like, I think that weirdly enough, word of mouth is, like, an even stronger way of getting the video seen and making it have more of, like, an impact.
And it also seems like, too, that there's an element of this that is about if the purpose of the video is as almost a portfolio piece to be paid to do similar things or bigger scale things, too, right? I mean, you guys, even in Britannic, right, you guys have have done stuff together. Like you guys made a pilot, right? That was the identity of your group.
Yeah.
Right. And sort of like have worked together and sort of traded it up for industry opportunities.
Yeah. And I think that's what we, you know, that's what I, you know, and again, I don't know if this is right. I say we don't want to be branded as YouTube stars. Like we've kept out of like the VidCon world and like really marketing ourselves as that and trying to get big in that way,
yeah.
Because we're like, well, we'd rather have it be, you know, we'd rather get real jobs writing for TV shows or writing movies or whatever, ideally. But then, you know, who knows? TV is dying and
right.
YouTube is flourishing. So who knows if that's the right way of operating. But
I think the sad thing to me about the state of the internet right now is that there was a time period, I think maybe 2010, 2011, where it seemed like you were going, and this might just be my personal experience, but it was like, it seemed like we were going to be able to make a living on YouTube. Like the ad revenue was good and the views were great. And then the ad revenue just started declining and declining. But it seemed for a point where like, oh, this is TV now and it's been democratized and the gatekeepers are gone and you can make exactly what you want to make and put it on YouTube and there'll be ad revenue and it can at least support itself. And then I think, you know, things started changing. YouTube changes their algorithm. Facebook comes up and the money's just gone down now where it's like the only way you can really make a living doing that is if you have sponsorship in some way.
Sure.
Which is, you know, now if you take money from somebody, you're having to, you know, follow somebody else's notes or somebody else's rules. So it just seemed like there was a moment where it was like, you know, the execs in the corner offices aren't relevant anymore. Like we can make stuff direct to our fans. And then, you know, YouTube starts an initiative where they give $1 million to Shaquille O'Neal and other people to, you know, start their own channels.
Yeah.
And then in came all of these, the gatekeepers like showed up, the middlemen showed up, the multi-channel network showed up and started, putting more and more layers between, you know, the creator and YouTube even.
Yeah.
And it's depressing.
What do you think about that? There's a website called Patreon that does so basically a rolling Kickstarter, like, hi, my name's Charlie. I make videos. Give me $1 per video a month. I know that they're small right now. But
yeah,
how do you
I think
feel
about Patreon
this?
Is great for certain people. I personally do not like asking for money. I do not want to ever ask my fans for money, which I don't know. That's just my personal thing. I don't like it.
So then you're comfortable with advertising in front of your videos?
I mean, a pre-roll advertisement on YouTube. I don't mind asking somebody to sit through a 30-second ad or install an ad blocker to see my content. But I think Patreon is great. I mean, especially like, you know, for musicians, if it's like there's something tangible, like I'm going to make an album or, mm-hmm. I mean, it probably could work for Improv Everywhere because I think we have enough of a fan base. If I said, hey, instead of doing a video every 6 weeks, I'm going to do one every week. If I get enough people to be backers, I probably would work. But I don't know. I just don't like it.
Yeah. And I mean, it is really interesting because it's like there's a blueprint, right, for a couple of years. And then it evolves and it changes and it changes and it changes. And it's like, and even what you're saying right here is like, it seems like television's dying, but at the same time, it feels like there's more sort of like of that core, you know, that sort of corporate big media influence on the internet too.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's moving and changing so fast.
It feels like it's just, we're just we pissed off the TV gods by creating TiVo. And it's just, I think we just all need to go, all right, we'll just watch commercials.
I don't think we're ever going to do it again. Like I've had a DVR since 2001. Like I can't, like every, like I tried to watch like Baskets. Like I forgot the TiVo Baskets when it was on and everybody was talking about it. Oh, I'll have FX on demand on my cable box. And I started watching it and there were commercial breaks that you can fast forward through. And I just like, I'm not going to watch this until it comes on another format. Especially because in demand, it's the same fucking commercial every
over
break.
And over and over. Yeah.
The one thing, though, is that I'd prefer that than making the creator fucking work in a brand into the show. Where they're all right, let's solve this crime after I enjoy this delicious Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
And
you're seeing that more and more
And it's like what's going to happen is you're going to have every, you know, people are pulling your stuff off of Netflix and then you're going to have all these different subscriptions like where you're paying $15 a month for HBO, and then you're also paying $15 a month for like, you know, Comedy Central will be next, and then that'll get bundled, and then it'll essentially be the same thing as basic cable package. Yeah.
It's we all are so excited to cut the cord and stop paying $100 a month for cable so that we can buy CISO for $4, Hulu for $10, HBO Now for $15, and you add it all up, and it's like, okay, I'm paying a fucking $100 again. Like,
yeah. Definitely.
To the point that I'm like, let's just TV. Maybe we had it right, guys. Let's just watch TV and have there be commercials and not pay anything for it.
But it definitely seems like, it's moving. It's moving so quickly. It's evolving, but it's all the sort of same iterations of like what it was. But then when it comes down to it, it seems like really it's about like, what are you making in what format and what are your goals with it? That seems like the important like decision to make. Right,
and you're not going to make things fastest, probably. So, what are you making that's you, and what are you making that like highlights a point of view that hasn't been in the media before?
And it seems like even that feels like it's a common theme and something that I feel like I'm hearing a lot right now. Whereas a few years ago, it was like get to it first, have something go viral very quickly, have something that feels topical that gets shared around all these influencer sites. You know what I mean, like. Be the news story today as the way to break through. And now it feels like it's a little bit more like do something of merit that can sort of be reflective of you to trade up and do bigger things.
Yeah, and I think that the reason why that those things don't really work anymore is because we're now controlled by algorithms instead of people being like, ooh, this is new. Let's like talk about this, whatever thing we're talking about, the Brexit.
You know, I have one more rant in me because you said the word influencer. I hate the word influencer so much, and it gets to what you're talking about too with like product placement, and that's the only way creators can make things. But you know, multi-channel networks refer to their YouTube channels that they own as influencers. The one that I'm in refers to me as an influencer when they're trying to pitch me for somebody to sponsor my videos, and it's just like I think it's such a toxic word. The fact that we have been turned. We're no longer creators. We're no longer creative people that go out and make things.
Yeah.
We are influencers. So what does that mean? What does an influencer mean? It means you can influence an audience to buy products, right? And people willingly accept that term and say, like, yeah, I'm a Instagram influencer. I'm a Twitter influencer, a Snapchat influencer. I think it's just disgusting. Like, I don't know. I wish that the industry – I think it's just kind of very bold-faced of the industry to be like, yep, this guy's an influencer. He can make 14-year-olds buy shit, so you got to work with him.
This guy is a soda salesman.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. Yeah, yeah. This guy can trick 13-year-olds into buying soda if he drinks it while he does a 6-second Vine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also hate the word content. I think it's really, really empty and sad.
Yeah, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. It's just content.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
things to put ads around.
Yeah. Well, I think we're out of time here, guys, but thanks so much for doing this and sitting down and talking about this. It's a really like important conversation, I think, for people who are making things. For you guys right now, where do you want to direct people to? Where should people go to see your work?
Everybody should download Feedly, which is an RSS reader.
Okay.
And you should go to typeinimproveverywhere.com and subscribe to my RSS feed. And that RSS is a standard that's not controlled by an algorithm. It's not controlled by money. It's why Google killed Google Reader because they realized that they couldn't make money off of it. Because similar to a podcast feed, podcasts are built on RSS as well, although there's companies trying to change that so they can insert ads into it and corrupt that. But RSS or email, sign up for my email list or my RSS feed. But if you sign up for my email list, it's going to go to your like promo folder in your Gmail. So you got to drag it over to your regular folder. Like every direct channel I've built with my audience, like some giant Google-owned company has tried to
get in the way of it.
Get in the way of it. So RSS readers.
RSS reader.
ImprovEverywhere.com/RSS.
Okay. How about for you, Paul?
Facebook.com/PaulGaleComedy. Very regrettably, but that's what it is. And twitter.com/IamPaulGale, like I'm Paul Gale.
Radical. Nick?
If you go to Britannic.com, that's Britannic, that's the name that two grown men perform under. All of our videos are there. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick Kocher. Don't follow the Britannic Twitter account. We never use that.
Okay.
We're very lazy.
Okay, and thanks so much, y'all, for coming out. Thanks to you at home.
Thank you, Nate.
This This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.